bizarre attempts, TBA.
Now, Gord said it was thermal beta ansatz. Yeah, I should start off with an apology for not having the title to you earlier. I kind of was intending originally to talk about brain inflation and connections between ideas as to how to embed brain ideas into cosmology. But there was this interesting stuff I was doing, and it seemed like it was more up the alley of this conference if it's about brain and supersymmetry. So I'm not going to talk about cosmology, so anyone who thinks it's going to be a cosmology talk should leave. It's about fixing the runaway moduli, I'm going to describe to you the vacuum of six-dimensional supergravity, and I'm going to argue for you that there six-dimensional supergravity may, but certain four-dimensional supergravities that are inspired by the six-dimensional supergravity do have interesting properties in the sense that they generate, they stabilize the moduli that are typically needing stabilizing. And my motivation for thinking of those, as you'll see, is largely cosmological, and I'll kind of give you some of those motivations when I'm there. The people I'm doing this with are my student Yashar Agavabi, Susha Parameswaran, who's one of Fernando Quevedo's students, and Fernando himself. Okay, so my convention for giving talks is that I think that giving the conclusion slide at the end is really the bad way to do it, because nobody ever makes it that far. So this is the conclusion, and if you remember nothing else, you can remember this slide, and it'll have been a success. So what I want to sell to you is that six-dimensional supergravity can pack divide in this very specific way, which is the Salam-Sazgin way. It's a way which I'm embarrassed to admit I'm old enough to remember when Salam and Sazgin did it. But it's a compactification of supergravity in six dimensions to four dimensions, which has had nice features then, it has nice features now, and I'm going to tell you about them. And I'm going to tell you a little bit more about them than they did then, because they weren't really motivated to pursue it. So that'll be the facts part. That's going to be a real calculation, and what I'll tell you there won't be false. And this is the also hopefully not false part, but which I can't prove to you is right. And I'm going to write down a four-dimensional supergravity theory, which, except for one part, is literally what you get from the six-dimensional compactification of six-dimensional supergravity. But there's an extra piece in it which is plausible, but is the one that you want to think about. But anyway, I'll write down the theory, which is just so irresistible to write down once you've looked at this, and you'll see that it has these nice features. The six-dimensional theory, the honest-to-God calculation, stabilizes one of the moduli. There's kind of two moduli in this problem, which are the archetypes of moduli in supergravity, S and T. The T is this one modulus T, which is describing the shape of the compactification. It gets stabilized in the six-dimensional theory, and that's kind of why they were interested in it in the 80s. But then this field S, which is kind of the dilaton, which typically doesn't get stabilized, I'll show you that in this four-dimensional theory, or I'll tell you in this four-dimensional theory, it does get stabilized, and the interesting thing is it gets stabilized at an exponentially large value, so that whereas this field T gets stabilized at order 1 over G squared, where G is a small parameter and it's a gauge coupling in the six-dimensional theory, this field S gets stabilized at exponentials of 1 over G squared, and so it's enormous. And that's interesting from the point of view of low-energy physics, because understanding the size of hierarchies is kind of what we like to do. And so that's kind of what part of the motivation. It's related to it. So I'll show you later on that S is a combination of the dilaton and the radius. And the way that these two things are both satisfied is that the radius is going to be very large. And the string... Yeah, depending on what you want to do. I can make it a good thing for you. I can make it a bad thing, too, if you... I'll elaborate on that when I get on with it. All right. So that's the point, and now let me tell you how I'm going to get to that point. So I'm going to remind you of this modulus stabilization biz, and starting off in 10 dimensions and then the four-dimensional analog of it. Whoops, I think I lost my antenna here. There you go. And part of the reason for doing that will be that the story will be much the same in six dimensions, and so a lot of the things I talk about then you can directly plug into. So in the guts of the description will be describing the six-dimensional supergravity and its compactification. and that'll be fairly mundane and straightforward. And the final part will be this four-dimensional motivated, a theory motivated by the six-dimensional theory. And then I'll close with the applications, which will be the part about why you're going to like having it big. And you'll see there are many applications of the idea. So what's the runaway story? I'm going to phrase all this in terms of supergravity. So the problem of runaways in supergravity, basically you can trace to two things, which really means three things, but two I'm going to tell you about now and one in the next slide. So if you look at the supergravity Lagrangian in 10 dimensions, that's the thing that everybody writes down. There's, you know, kinetic terms all around, and then there's that's for bosons and fermions. The typical players are metric, the dilaton, gauge fields of some gauge group, which I'll get to later, the antisymmetric tensor that's kind of generically there in these supergravity things. And you get all these couplings, but the feature that's, there's two features that are important that are responsible for these flat directions, classically. The first one is the one that was emphasized by the people in the 80s when they first made contact between string theory and supergravity. Maybe that's not the first time, but the loudest time. And the bottom line is that because you can write this Lagrangian with the dilaton undifferentiated out front as a prefactor, which is really expressing the fact that in string theory, this is the coupling constant, and this is a tree-level effect, so it's 1 over g squared. That says that there's a classical symmetry where I just shift phi. Nothing happens in the square brackets, but we get an overall factor in the Lagrangian, which doesn't mean that it's a symmetry, but it says that the equations of motions are not changed by that process. And so the classical solutions won't tell you the value of phi, just based on that ground, which is a very general argument. The second argument like that, which is equally general, but which the six-dimensional theory won't have, is that every term here has either two derivatives of bosons or one derivative for fermions. And so if you count two fermions as a derivative, then if I scale the derivative by a factor and the fermions by the square root of the factor, the whole Lagrangian scales the same way because it's all stuff involving two derivatives or trade a derivative for pairs of fermions. So because of that, that's why you can never pin down the radius of the extra dimensions, because if you know, the radius is more or less the derivatives of the metric, and so you can scale those things without changing the classical equation. So again, the classical equations won't tell you, as long as it's just two derivatives, what the radius is. And radius is going to mean for me the thing in front of the extra dimensional metrics, and I'm not going to be following off diagonal stuff for the most part. So the generic problem is that you've got radii, and typically, depending on the space you look at, there could be more moduli than just radii and the dilaton that are not being fixed classically. And normally you would have thought, and in the old days people did think, that that's a great thing, because since that's not an exact symmetry, it's only an approximate symmetry classically, then quantum corrections will lift the degeneracy, and then you'll be able to predict what stabilizes these things. And that's, of course, where the bad news starts. Bad news starts is because as long as you look at a compactification which doesn't break supersymmetry, then what you find is that flat directions that are there classically are really there. And they're not lifted by perturbation theory, and they can be lifted by non-perturbative effects, but because they require non-perturbative effects, it's hard to know what they are. So if you look at in the 10-dimensional supergravity, I should say right away that I wrote these transparencies when I couldn't get access to the web, and so there's no references to anybody. And so to make that, you know, so I apologize if you're here and I haven't referred to you, but to be fair, I'm not going to refer to myself either, so it's you'll never know what I did in this. What's that? Well, in this particular slide, it was 15 years ago, and it's mean. It's one of the people not being referred to. But so that's the deal. I'm not going to refer to anybody. And my apologies, but it's a story. So just listen to the story and enjoy it. So the deal is, if you look at it, you're typically, if you're thinking that this compactification scale is very high compared to ordinary scales of physics, then and if you're also thinking that the supersymmetry is going to break near ordinary scales of physics, which there are reasonable reasons to believe, then you would expect that the compactification itself is not going to break supersymmetry, because that would have broken it at all the supersymmetries anyway at higher scales. And so people tend to focus on compactifications that are supersymmetric, and then that means that in the low-energy four-dimensional theory of the massless states that are lighter than all the Kaluza-Klein states, which means lighter than 1 over r, if r is the radius, those states should organize themselves into supermultiplets, and you should be able to write down an effective four-dimensional supergravity. And in particular, the dilaton and the radius and two other light fields that are associated with this antisymmetric tensor in the action group themselves into these generic moduli. plus there could be others that you also get. And it's combinations of the dilaton and the radius. And the condition that the radii be large, which is typically what you believe, if you must have if you're going to believe the field theory limit as a description of something like string theory, means that this thing wants to be large. And also phi, the conventions I'm using here, e to the phi should be small in string perturbation theory. So this one certainly wants to be large, and this one, it depends on who's larger there, who's smaller. So we're thinking about variables where S and T are large, typically. So if you actually do the math and you figure out what the supergravity Lagrangian is at low energies, it's completely specified by a few functions. You know, the gauge kinetic function, the superpotential, the Kähler function. And this is what it turns out to be if you take the 10-dimensional supergravity Lagrangian and you compactify on a Calabi-Yau space or something like we did in the 80s. You find that this variable S is the gauge coupling constant. It's the thing in front of the gauge kinetic function. The superpotential depends on various matter fields. These would have been the E6 things that come from. These are coming from gauge fields in the extra dimensions from the heterotic string. They're the kind of the extra-dimensional pieces of the gauge fields act like matter. And the Kähler function has this particular form, which just tells you really that the logarithms are telling you that you like to get from the Einstein action kinetic terms which are of the form d field over field. So it's the logarithm of the field which is the canonical variable. And that's reflected by these logarithms. The 3 is magic. The minus 1 is magic. 3 is the no-scale thing. But the problem is that dot, dot, dots are really there. The superpotential and the gauge kinetic functions are holomorphic functions, and because of that, they have these strong non-renormalization conditions. They don't get corrected to all orders in perturbation theory and so on. But this thing does get corrected, and you expect, therefore, that the coefficient of this logarithm and the non-logarithmic terms are all some series in 1 over S and 1 over T to the extent that those are the coupling constants in the problem. And that's really the dirty part of dealing with these supergravity Lagrangians at low energies. But this is the leading term. This is the thing you get directly in a classical limit. Now, if you look at the non-perturbative, so people have, you know, once you have a supergravity, then you can actually say a lot about it, because particularly you can say a lot about these functions. And there are instances where people can calculate for you what the non-perturbative effects do, such as when you have gauge condensation going on. If you have a non-abelian group in the low-energy theory, it happens that you typically get exponentials for the superpotential once the gauge is condensed. And because it's supersymmetric and because this is holomorphic, you can actually really nail down what these coefficients are, particularly A. It's related to the beta function. And I want you just to remember that down the road, because I'm going to use that again later on, that it's exponential. This exponential is not such a big surprise. If you think of S being 1 over the coupling constant squared, which it would be if it's the gauge kinetic function, this is something which is e to the minus 1 over g squared, which is a non-perturbative dependence. All right, so that's the problem. The problem is, classically, you've got nothing fixing the radii and the dilaton. If it's supersymmetric, then that's really not just a classical problem. It's a problem to all orders in perturbation theory, and it becomes more difficult, but not impossible, to talk about what the low-energy theory is. One thing I forgot to say here is that once you do get a potential for these things, it tends to be the runaway potential. In this case, if you stick this into the supergravity expression for the scalar potential, it gives you things that are proportional to this squared, and so it likes S to run off to infinity. And that's telling you that S to infinity is the weak coupling limit. That's taking you to free string theory. And that's saying that these non-perturbative effects typically are proportional. This expression, you can think of it as being the confinement scale for the non-abelian gauge theory cubed, just which is what eventually it would have to be. And so the way, you know, what's special about supergravity and string theory is that things that were parameters or could have been parameters, like the gauge couplings, are really fields because everybody's an expectation value. And so it's not enough to find that you get a potential as a function of the gauge coupling. You have to then minimize over the gauge coupling, and that's the thing that actually kills you in the end, because it takes you to weak coupling and turns the potential off again. So that's the dilaton runaway problem. So non-perturbatively, you can get potentials in some circumstances, but typically the potential you get drives you off to infinity rather than snagging you at finite values. All right, why is this bad? These are my personal reasons. The first one is not such a personal reason, but if you talk to people that don't like string theory, this is what they'll tell you, is that string theory doesn't really predict anything. It's because there's so many vacua, blah, blah, blah. Who cares if you've got one theory, if you've got enough vacua that it's the same thing as having a lot of parameters? Those parameters are there because you can't dynamically determine them, and so you'd like to have a potential for them to know what they are, and you can't until you solve this modulus problem. The three things that I'm going to sell you as being the reasons that are making this more pressing now are, one of them is not so recent, but the two cosmological ones are more recent. I'm telling you about them now as motivations, partly because the thing I'm going to show you addresses some of them, so it's not completely a random selection of things here. One of the problems, which is not really a recent one, is supersymmetry breaking. If you ever want to make contact between string theory and anything, you have to make contact with experiment eventually. And the hang-up there is the supersymmetry breaking. How does supersymmetry break? Because string theory actually predicts the electron mass, and it gets it right, and the answer it gives you is 0.0000 in Planck units, and that's the right answer. But it's not accurate enough to tell you anything, because the real experimental number is, you know, 23 zeros and then a 5 at the end. And to do the things that accurately, you have to break supersymmetry, because supersymmetry is making all orders of perturbation theory small, or zero. And so it's only once you break supersymmetry you get to predict anything you can test. And so supersymmetry breaking is the thing that you want to understand. And it typically is non-perturbative, which is what's relating it to the lifting of these degeneracies. Now, what's interesting about it from my point of view is what's interesting about brain physics. The reason brain physics is exciting is that it's not that they're there, it's that brain physics cuts right to the core of most of the naturalness issues at low energies. And I have to confess at this point that I'm not a string theorist, so my motivation isn't really so much that I'm trying to salvage string theory. What I'm interested in about brain physics is that, string theory is probably right. But what's interesting about brain physics is that there are many naturalness problems at low energies, and what's special about naturalness problems is that they are places where the low energy theory is sensitive to the high energy physics. And so if you want to learn something about high energy physics or have high energy physics tell you something about low energy physics, it will be precisely at the naturalness places. And most of the naturalness problems are hard because people have thought about them for a long time and no one's gotten anywhere. And that normally means that there's a hidden assumption that everybody's making and not making explicit that is taking everybody in the wrong direction. And brain physics cuts to one of those assumptions which everybody had made, which was that all the interactions at low energy see the same number of dimensions. And that turns out to cut in an interesting way at the various naturalness issues at low energies. In particular, supersymmetry breaking can be much more diverse and varied than it had been thought. And so you can imagine that we live on a brain and there's another brain over there which breaks supersymmetries, and the bulk that connects us between our world and the world that breaks the rest of the supersymmetries imagine a world where the extra dimensions have two supersymmetries. We have one in our brain and there's another brain which has one, but it's the other one. So in that world, all supersymmetries are broken, but the way we learn about the supersymmetry breaking is very, very special because it goes through a region or a part of the theory which has much more supersymmetry than we think is there. So that kind of thing is something you would not have really been led to if you hadn't been thinking along the lines of brains, but it has the potential for addressing naturalness issues to do with, say, flavor changing when you break supersymmetry. There's many reasons why supersymmetry breaking becomes particularly interesting in brain physics, and one of the motivations for thinking of these models is that they are the simplest context in which to embed brains and ask questions about things like supersymmetry breaking. Cosmology is also driving part of this story, and the two things that I want you to remember there is that there's two kinds of cosmology to make contact with these days. Very early universe cosmology is, essentially going to be inflation. It's where the experimental limits are much, you know less about what's going on at the universe, but you can imagine that if you fill it with brains, you're going to change the dynamics at high energies. And in particular, it's been shown that motion of brains can, in some circumstances, give you inflation, provided that some things are true. And the things that have to be true, and which nobody normally makes explicit in these brain inflation models, is that all these moduli have to be fixed, except for the one that you're following as the inflaton. And the reason they have to be fixed is easy to understand. In the effective theory, if you have a lot of moduli running around with no potential energy, to get inflation, the definition of inflation is that you've got dynamics where the potential energy is dominating the energy. But if you've got a lot of fields which have no potential energy, anything at all that excites them makes them want to roll, and then you've got kinetic energy that you have to worry could be dominating the potential energy that you like. And so it's always an issue in any of these string-motivated inflation scenarios of how the moduli get fixed. And in particular, it's been recognized that if you fix just radii or dilaton, you typically don't get inflation to work. But if you fix the supersymmetric combinations like S and T, which is a combination of the radion and dilaton, which supersymmetry would like to transform together, then you can get inflationary ideas to work. And so examples where you stabilize these things in a supersymmetric context are interesting from the point of view of inflation for that reason. The second is kind of a cosmology that you care about in this context is the description of what is the dark energy, and is it in particular something which is dynamic, changing now? Is it like quintessence as opposed to a cosmological constant? The problem here is naturalness is a really useful tool in this kind of a problem, because these, to have a scalar field or something evolving now, it has to have an extremely small mass, where extremely small means 10 to the minus 33 electron volts. And if you take a list of all the theories of quintessence that have been proposed, essentially none of them can give you an understanding as to why you can get a mass that's that small for a scalar field. It's worse than the hierarchy problem to have a mass that small. That's incredibly small compared to all the other scales we know about, including the cosmological constant, which is normally thought to be so small it's really hard to understand. But there are exceptions to that, one of which involves the radion in six dimensions, where the six dimensions are large as they could possibly be, you know, which is close to the cosmological constant in size. And so, in particular, cosmologists looking at the kind of potentials that work in cosmology will tell you that logarithmic kind of potentials for the radion are the things that from the point of view of cosmology, do a reasonably good job of describing the late universe. And so if you can find a six-dimensional model where the potential for the radius is logarithmic, then that's going to be potentially a good thing for applications of dark energy. So you can tell that I'm going to try and give you one that has logarithms in it. Okay, that's the motivation. So now hopefully you're all psyched. So now let me just tell you about the six-dimensional theory, which is actually quite short. So the six-dimensional theory looks like the four-dimensional theory, except there's some different numbers in front of the various terms. So I'm going to turn off all the fermions, as usual. Just the only non-zero fields in the background are the bosons. The thing that's different is this term. In six dimensions, you have a potential energy for the dilaton that you don't have in 10 dimensions, and that's going to be partly what fixes some of the moduli. Because one of the arguments I gave you at the beginning said that you only had second derivative terms, so you can scale them all and nothing changes, and that doesn't change the radius. That's now false, and that's going to be part of why this... That's really why they were thinking about this in one of the reasons why they're thinking about this back in the 80s. This coupling G squared is... the theory in six dimensions is supergravity, that's these fields, coupled to super-Yang-Mills. That's this field and its superpartners. And the gauge coupling for the super-Yang-Mills, I'm going to take it to be a U1 thing, as they did in the past, is G. And in six dimensions, gauge couplings have dimensions. So when I write G here, this is in Planck, in units of the six-dimensional Planck scale. So it's the dimensionless ratio of those couplings. And so that's the small dial you have, yeah?
Why is this term allowed in six dimensions and not in
10? One way to think about it is that from the point of view of four dimensions, the more dimensions you have, the more supersymmetry you have. And that makes it much more restrictive, the larger dimension you go.
How many terms?
In this case, this is... This is one complex vial spinner in six dimensions, which is like to be n equals 2 and 4.
Eight.
Depending how you count. Yeah, eight real things, yeah.
But if you start from 10 dimension compared to 5 to 6, you won't get that term?
Yeah, you can. That's the way they got this Lagrangian. They took I can't remember what the compact is. It depends what you do with the four dimensions. But you have to, the four dimensions that is between 6 and 10, you have to choose to break all the supersymmetries but the ones that you've kept. Because the 10-dimensional supergravity had more 6-dimensional supersymmetries than this has.
So if there's just one possibility, is that you always get a term like that, or it could be arbitrary?
Oh, no, there's other 6-dimensional supergravities that are not this, yeah.
Okay, there's 8 particular.
One way to kill this off is if you made the gauge coupling 0, then it's gone. And it's a generic thing in extended supersymmetries that if you gauge some of the groups in the problem, then you get potential energies for the scalars that you don't normally have.
So couples
the anti-symmetric tensor field to what? You mean in the Chern-Simons piece?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I've written it in a way where in my variables you wouldn't see the G in the Chern-Simons piece, but it's essentially, if you normalize things that's not in the kinetic term, it would be there. I lied to you. No, it actually is explicitly there. I don't have it in the kinetic term. It's also, every fermion in the problem carries this charge, so that the covariant derivative for the gravitino and everything has got a GA term. And that's why this is, so that means that it's got to be, because the fermions carry the charge and the bosons don't, this is you've gauged an R symmetry, and that's the thing that tends to give you potentials in supergravity. All right, now you do the dumb thing. You look for a Freund-Rubin adsatz, which is essentially you're looking for a maximally symmetric solution. And what was striking to the people in the 80s was that you don't require this to be flat space. You say it's either de Sitter space, anti de Sitter space, or Minkowski space. But you take this to be maximally symmetric too, so it's a sphere. So it doesn't get simpler than that, except for tori. And those symmetries allow you also to have a non-zero term for the electromagnetic field. in that it could be proportional to the volume form in the, on the sphere with some coefficient, and you're going to determine these coefficients. So there'll be an R squared here, there'll be a four-dimensional metric, which is maxis metric here, and F here. And this F, actually, this kind of a field strength corresponds to a magnetic monopole configuration on the two-sphere, and so it's going to be, its coefficient is quantized, and there's an integer that you have to choose. And now, if you ask, you solve Einstein's equations, the Maxwell equation, and the Dilaton equation, it happens that a solution exists provided that these three conditions are solved. And they say that the plus or minus one here says that you have to choose a monopole number one, or minus one, but not anything else. This condition says that the one combination of the radius and the dilaton is fixed in terms of g squared. This is going to be t, essentially. And this condition says you have to live in flat space. And that was the thing that was exciting to them, was that they didn't actually design that you were in flat space, but you got a potential which turns out to be a perfect square, which is minimized that flat space. And that, at first sight, seemed like it was a miracle, but it wasn't a miracle when they looked at the supersymmetry of the problem. This compactification, this condition that you have winding number one for the monopole, is the condition that you have unbroken n equals one supersymmetry in four dimensions. And so then it's not such a big surprise that the vacuum is minimized at flat space. Could have been anti-de-Sitter space, but it happens in this case it's flat
space.
Was
the gauge field and the anti-symmetric point in four dimensions are zero?
Yeah, this is all zero.
B is also zero,
yeah. The invariant thing would have been H, and the thing is that there's nothing with three indices is always zero in two dimensions, so it's... Sorry?
R is the radius of the
sphere. Well, if the dilaton hadn't been there, it would have been fixed, but it's not... in this case, it's not fixed because the... there's a combination of the radius and the dilaton that's fixed. So one combination can change and the other one can't. But if you were to freeze the dilaton, then it would be true the radius would be fixed. So what's the light theory? I'm interested in writing down what the four-dimensional supergravity is for that compactification. So that means that I have to go to energies below 1 over R, which is the place where the theory starts to look four-dimensional, and ask, since it's supersymmetric, I can ask what are the supermultiplets, and then I can ask what are the gauge kinetic functions and the superpotential and all those things. And this is the part actually that Salam and Sezgin got wrong, because they were writing papers very quickly and string theory had just started, and you can just tell that they were about to drop this and do something else. And so they misidentify the low energy spectrum, and that's probably why nobody's written down this supergravity before. Because if you try to do it with what they said was the massless spectrum, you'd get the wrong answer. Or you can't do it. So the massless states are the graviton, because you've got general covariance in the four dimensions. You've got an SO3 group of isometries of the two-sphere, and so that will show up as gauge bosons in four dimensions, which will emerge from the metric, the off-diagonal part of the metric, in the Kaluza-Klein way. B-mu, and so the B-mu in the four dimensions can be dualized to a scalar field, which is massless. And then this combination of R and phi is not determined by the classical equations of motion, and it's a massless scalar. And so these two things will group into a complex scalar, which is going to be part of a chiral superfield. These guys are going to live in a gauge multiplet, and this will be the gravity multiplet. And the way you can kind of see that this is the variable which is massless is that you can take the Lagrangian classically and specialize to the ansatz that I took. And it looks like this. So this is the potential energy term. This is the Einstein term in the extra dimension. So there's just a curvature in the extra dimension. And this is the Maxwell term. If you write the R dependence and the phi dependence of that, keeping in mind you have to rescale the metric to make the Einstein term canonical, then you get this, essentially. You get three terms, which depend differently on e to the phi, which become a perfect square. And so if you minimize the square, then you get the condition I told you, that R squared e to the phi is fixed, and it's order 1 over g squared. But once you've minimized that, that's 0, and then this variable is something which is now unconstrained, and it's parameterized in the flat direction. So that's where this definition came from. It's also true that if you go to the kinetic energy and ask, if this is one variable and this is the other variable, does the kinetic energy diagonalize? It does. Now, the thing that Salam and Sezgin got wrong was they also said that the U1 gauge boson that you had running around from start to from the beginning is also massless, and that was very plausible because there were no charged fields in the problem, so how could you give it a mass? Turns out it's wrong because there's a Chern-Simons piece in the field strength for this anti-symmetric tensor, and so that means that the Chern-Simons piece is not gauge invariant under the U1, and so that means that the anti-symmetric tensor has to transform under U1 gauge transformations, and it turns out it transforms, if A transforms this way, B transforms in this way, and so it's proportional to the field strength of the gauge field. And in particular, if you give it an expectation value, this variation isn't zero, and so that means that the compactification breaks the U1, and that means you should expect to get a mass for the corresponding gauge field. And that's the right answer because that's going to, this field here, T, has got a mass because it's got a potential. And if you ask who does it live with supersymmetrically, you can't get things to match unless you realize that this is actually the scalar that's in a massive vector multiplet, which goes with this gauge field. So it works out that you've got a U1 gauge multiplet, and it eats a chiral multiplet whose scalar part is this variable T in the potential, and another variable B, which is the piece of the antisymmetric tensor which lives purely in the extra dimensions, as it looks like a scalar, it turns out. If this was proportional to the volume form, B would be its coefficient. And this is the extent of the Goldstone boson that gets eaten by the gauge boson. Yeah.
So this B that you've written, can you make a little sketch with B versus R? Does it have a single minimum?
Yeah, it has. You can see that it's got a. It depends. There's two variables, so that it's got a trough minimum. So if you had to sketch it, it would be like this. It's something like that, and then there's a trough. So along this direction is S, and along this direction is T. And it's literally a parabola for 1/T here. That's because that's what that is. Okay. Now, you could say that if this gets a mass, why do I keep it in the four-dimensional theory? And the point is that it gets a mass which is smaller than the compactification scale. Its mass turns out to be g squared e to the phi over r squared. And 1 over r squared is the thing that defines the cutoff for the four-dimensional theory. So these are all small things. And so they're telling you that this is a light, not massless, but still systematically light field. And that's why it's allowed to be in the four-dimensional theory. So given that, you can read off the gauge, the supergravity things. And the perfect square is a giveaway what the potential energy is going to be. The way you get a perfect square, there's two ways to get a perfect square in supergravity. One of them is a no-scale model, and this is not one. The superpotential is zero in this case, but you get a perfect square because you have a phi A Lapalus term, which is proportional to G, and then the gauge kinetic term, the Kähler function is logarithmic. But it has a piece, it doesn't just depend on S and T the way it did in 10 dimensions. There's a piece which also depends on this U1 gauge field. And this combination has to be what appears in the Kähler function, because that's saying that the Goldstone boson had to always appear with a gauge field that it's going to eat it. So there's in components, this field B always appears in the combination d mu B plus A mu with some normalization factors, because that says that if I go to a special gauge, I can completely remove this thing and see that the gauge field is massive. And so in superspace language, the fact that these things only appear in this combination is expressed in this way, that the imaginary part of T goes together with the vector part of this gauge multiplet. So if I now look at the D terms, the D term potential for this U1 part, it's got a coefficient which is 1 over S, because the gauge coupling function for the U1 is S, whereas the gauge coupling function for the SO3 isometry group, gauge group, is T, it turns out. So if you look at the D term is it's D squared, with normalization, which is to do with the gauge coupling constant. And the D term has got a phi A Lapalus component plus the derivative of K with respect to the gauge multiplet. And if you use this logarithm, this is 1/T. And this literally is the potential I showed you before, the perfect square. And that's kind of how you can read off what these functions are. Okay. So what that's done for you is it's explicitly stabilized this modulus T semi-classically. And that's not one of the things I'm going to be lying to you about. That's something which is designed to do. It does it because ultimately the supergravity theory involved both a potential and two derivative terms, and so that scale invariance argument failed. And so classically you can stabilize one combination of R and phi.
I'm sorry, are the little t and little s combinations of R and phi?
Yes.
What ones are
they? Basically it's this. It's written down on a slide somewhere, but here's T, it's R squared e to the phi, and S is R squared e to the minus phi.
Okay.
And I had one of these high-tech. So I told you this was a Kähler function, but as I told you before, the Kähler function is the one that gets corrections, and so those corrections you should expect to go like 1 over S and 1 over T, because those are the gauge coupling constants. So what you expect really is that the Kähler function is going to look something like this. It'll be a logarithm with 1 plus corrections, which are down by powers of 1 over S and 1 over T, a logarithm, which is also corrected, 1 plus stuff, and then non-logarithmic terms. Okay, so that's the thing that you like to use. And this, the black stuff is this motivated part. So in principle, you can calculate all these things. A, these A's are constants, and these B's are constants, and these K's are constants, and you can calculate them in six dimensions, and I haven't done that. And in particular, the one that's going to do things for me is A. So if you could prove that A is non-zero in the six-dimensional supergravity theory, then it's no longer six-dimensional motivated. It would be really the low-energy limit of six-dimensional theory. And so I can talk to people about where that comes from and whether it's plausible that you could get that term, but that's the assumption I'm going to make.
Your process for this U1 part?
Yeah, it's for this U1, the six-dimensional U1.
Any other field charged on this?
The fermions were charged in six dimensions. But when you go to four dimensions, what happens is that the... No one's charged in four dimensions except only this B. So in the sense that B shifts, but nobody carries charge in the usual sense. And that's because the fermions in six dimensions have powers of E to the IB rolled into them, so they're all neutral. Okay, so the important thing is that black is bad and it's the motivated part, but very plausible, don't you think? And then the stuff that's not black is really, honest to God, there classically. So what's this thing look like? What is the? It looks like there's a flat direction, and so we can ask the question: does that direction get lifted? And there's hope because the low energy theory had a massless gauge multiplet, which is non-abelian. There's an SO3 gauge theory there, corresponding to the isometries of the sphere, and so you expect that's going to go through. And the only thing that carries those SO3 quorum numbers are the gauge enos in the gauge field. So we know it's asymptotically free. We know that the gauge enos will condense, and so that will generically produce a superpotential non-perturbatively, which we can calculate. So that's what we'll calculate. So we're going to go to very low energies compared to the ones we've talked about. And so the scales, just to remind you, that we talked about are, there's a Planck scale, which was 1 in all the slides I talked about. The four-dimensional cutoff is 1 over r. The mass, which was the gauge multiplet had, which was light compared to 1 over r, was this. And if you kind of translate into what t was here, it turns out to be that. So it's like the m sub c is a geometric mean between this scale and the Planck scale. So there's a hierarchy there, classically. And now there's a new scale, which is the confinement scale for this SO3 gauge theory. So it's going to be the compactification scale, which is the cutoff, times an e to the minus 1 over g squared, which is saying that the coupling runs logarithmically, and so it has to go a long ways before it gets big. So that's the confinement scale, and that's the new scale in the problem, and we want to know at that scale, at that scale we expect a superpotential to get generated. It does get generated. This is what it is. It's exponential in the coupling that's relevant for SO3. And then the question then becomes, once that happens, what's the potential for S? Is it a runaway, or what's it look like? So the way to think of this is that you can think of omega or W naught to be systematically small, and what you're really thinking is that this exponential is systematically small. You can kind of dial it a little bit by adjusting what the initial value of the coupling constant was at the cutoff. If you do that, then the potential energy is dominated by the one that we calculated classically, which is this D term. And so this flat direction is normally called the D-flat direction because it's the zero of the D term in the potential. And that D-flat direction, now we can ask what's the effective theory along that trough when we turn the superpotential on. And so the D-flat direction classically was just fixes T and didn't depend on it. So S was the parameter along the D-flat direction. So what we're interested in is we're thinking of the potential energy here as being, this is a constant, T, because it's been fixed by the D-flat direction. To the extent that this is small, so the D potential wins over the F potential. And we're interested, how does the answer depend on S? And if we use the lowest order Kähler function, the answer is a runaway, because the potential energy, which depends on the superpotential, has a piece which is E to the K out front, and then stuff involving the superpotential. And all you care about the stuff involving the superpotential is that it doesn't depend on S, basically. That's the important thing. And this E to the K has a 1 over S in it because of that logarithm, and that's the thing which drives the runaway. So S wants to run off to infinity. And that argument is the thing that will change as soon as you put in these corrections that were in black. And that's the thought of the day. That if you take the supergravity, which has these 1 over T corrections in front of the logarithm, everything becomes more complicated in an interesting way. So that's the point of the rest of the talk. So there's two more slides. I'm going to finish early. So now what I'm going to do is just repeat the same calculation with K, including these correction terms. And I'm looking for solutions now because I know where they're going to be, where T is large because it's order 1 over G squared is what we found already classically, but log S over T is not going to be negligible. So I'm when I do the expansion for large S and large T, I have to be careful about ratios of log S over T to not drop them too early. So what happens is the D-flat direction, the logic is essentially the same, though. If you imagine the superpotential being small, which you can always arrange, then the zeroth order, the theory likes to minimize the D term in the potential, and then you're raising that to leading order in the coefficient W naught. The potential that S sees will be the value along this trough of the F term potential, which I'm just going to calculate now using this K rather than the other K. Now, the main change is happening because the D flat direction is no longer independent of S, because you remember what it was the Phi A Laplace term. So D essentially was the Phi A Laplace term plus dk d gauge field, but that was the same thing as dk dt because they always appeared together. So because I've got a new term in dk dt, which depends on a logarithm, that's kind of what's changing the parameterization of the D-flat direction. So now it's kind of curved in ST space. It's no longer a straight line. But the curve is logarithmic in S. So what's going to happen is that the D-flat direction, if you look at this, you can see that it likes, log S likes to be, if I ask for this to be zero, the log S dependence will be important once log S is of the order of T. There's something else you could see from that. Not yet. The other thing you can see from this is that if I solve for log S, which is going to be the easier thing to do, supposing I just drop these terms because they're subdominant in 1 over T, then qualitatively you can see that the log S term is going to be quadratic in T because of this term, and then the linear in T term. And the solution I'm going to show for you is arising essentially, it's going to be dominated by the dependence of ds dt is going to be the thing that controls the vanishing of the derivative of the potential. And what's happening is because it's got a quadratic, log S is quadratic in T, there's a place where log S changes direction as T varies. And that's the solution that ultimately, that's responsible for the solution I'm going to show you. I'm actually not going to show it to you. I'm just going to tell you it's there. I lost heart here about writing the formula for the potential is actually very large, but it's essentially what it is what's going on is, I can tell you very simply, because it's so the statement of what's true with those functions is that T gets stabilized essentially where it was stabilized before, and S gets stabilized where log S over T is order 1. That's what the solution turns out to be. So that means S is of order e to the 1 over G squared. And the way that happens in detail is that the F-term potential, the effective potential as a function of S is, to a good approximation, it's just the F-term as a function of T of S and S. And that had a 1 over S factor in front of it. So if we think of T being the variable here rather than S, let's think of it that way, S of T, T. Then you've got 1 over S of T, and then you've got like a 1 over T, and you've got an e to the minus something times T, and things like that. And this S, you remember, is something like e to the t squared minus some number times t and other things. And your experience with saddle points tells you that when you find the stationary point with respect to t of this thing, the thing that dominates it is when S gets, the argument in the logarithm of S gets minimized. And all this other stationary stuff is subdominant in 1 over t when you vary things. And so the minimum that I'm claiming is there, you can see most easily by thinking of eliminating S as a function of T and then varying T, because this 1 over S is what's doing it to you. And it's doing it to you because it's not a monotonic function of T. Okay.
So when you eliminate F as a function of T, you're making a relationship between little r and T, right?
Yes. Right, but I was doing that before this superpotential, because back when it was flat, I was also doing that. If I said T is equal to 1, then that was also a relationship between R and T, R and Phi. So it's just a slightly different relationship than before. So here's the closing slide. Except I'm going to put the conclusions up at the end, but you've seen those already. So this is the last new slide. So what do you do with this? This is kind of things that we're thinking about. There's several things to do with this. One thing to do with it is to forget the brain motivation I gave you when I come in and say, well, look, this is this. If I ask the super, so what I've done is I've shown you that with this Kähler function, the potential energy here it's not exactly flat. It's got a bump in it, which is very, very large distance out there. And that says that the world would like to live there. And then you can ask things like, is that supersymmetric and things like that. And the answer is it's not supersymmetric, and that's kind of why you lifted the flat direction. So what's interesting about that is that this is essentially dynamical supersymmetry breaking, but it's one which has survived the dilaton runaway, and that S didn't run away to infinity, it got snagged someplace. And so you get a natural hierarchy in the supersymmetry breaking scale is systematically small compared to the other scales that you had in your problem, and then, of course, if you're a phenomenologist, you can start designing things to be where you want them to be. So if you take that as being the way the world works and the brains are irrelevant, then that is just a Kaluza-Klein model, and it has very predictive consequences, because if you work out the fact that S is so large, if you work that through and says, if you ask how does supersymmetry breaking feed into the standard model particles, people have had a lot to, not a lot to think about for 10 years, and so they thought a lot about how supersymmetry breaking, if you could figure out how it broke, how it feeds into the other particles. And so you can just plug into what they know, and the upshot is that this gives you a model where the dilaton expectation value dominates because it's enhanced by S. And that's a very predictive, people have recognized that for a long time as being a very predictive supersymmetry breaking scenario, and this would lead you to that supersymmetry breaking would be dominated by the dilaton. And so that's, you could rule it out as soon as you find the superpartners. So if that's the way things work. Now, going back to the cosmology motivations, there's several things to think about, because this is attractive from the two independent motivations I gave you. For inflationary models, you were looking for things which stabilized all the moduli but one, but did it in a supersymmetric way, so that it was T and S that were fixed, T or S that was fixed, and not R and phi. And this does that. So the next thing that you'd like to do is produce a potential which is S independent but non-zero, and then you'd have inflation, because that would be something which S is going to be in a flat direction and would have then a vacuum energy, and that vacuum energy would be the thing that drives inflation. But it's not exactly flat. It's got a small gradient, so it's going to slowly roll, and eventually it's going to fall off the potential. And so you can try and design an inflation model there. But it gets around, it's probably the only explicit supergravity model of inflation which gets around this modular stabilization, if you can get the second part right, the potential energy right. The quintessence, or the dark energy models, if you had eliminated T instead of S here, then the potential that you end up getting is something like 1 over S, A minus B log S. That's one way to see what's going on, where B is of the order of 1 over T minimum. So T naught, if you like, which is G squared. So let's call it G squared. And so if you minimize this, you can see that the minimum, you had the runaway, but then what's happening is that the logarithm wins, and so this likes to be ordered, this likes to be zero. There's one more piece coming from the derivative of that. But log S times G squared wants to be order one, and that's how you're getting the minimum. But this is exactly the kind of logarithmic potential that I was telling you looks good from the cosmology point of view for quintessence, that radions, just powers of S, which is powers of R, are not good. Those are exponentials in terms of the canonical variable. And the problem with exponentials is that you just keep on going, and you tend to get into tracker solutions which are never dominating the energy density of the universe. But these logarithms are just exactly what solves that, because they put little bumps in your exponential. And so now you can imagine getting snagged in that bump, and then that's why we're seeing the vacuum energy now, either temporarily because we keep on going, or for a long time if the dip is big enough. So it's very attractive to look for quintessence kind of models in this potential, because it's got the form that people recognize already as you'd like to have. So what was the point? The point was, there's a six-dimensional supergravity model which has a nice, rich, low-energy structure, even without the brains, and then it would be nice to put brains in, too, and see what happens. I can tell you some things about that, too, afterwards. The six-dimensional model by itself classically fixes the modulus T, and that was just because it had this D-term phi Eliopoulos kind of a form. And then if you believe the corrections are generic, the ones I wrote down, then it has the extra property that this flat direction gets lifted, because of the interplay between the logarithmic terms in the Kähler function and the superpotential. And then the D term and the F term fight each other, and they give you a potential for S, which has the interesting feature that it's exponentially large, given that T is large. And so, depending on how big you want S to be and how big you want the radius to be, which depends on if you're trying to explain the hierarchy by saying that the extra dimensions are a millimeter in size or not, you can kind of dial that a little bit with G in the six-dimensional theory. But there's lots of scope there for model building, and I hope it pays off. So thank you for your time.
An eventual question. Where did the superpotential come from? At some point you have to say this W is equal to this.
Yeah, it started off classically, it was zero, and then the non-normalization theorem says that all orders in perturbation theory is also zero. So that if you thought of it as a series in 1 over S, all the terms in the series are zero. But what happens physically is that, so you should think of it that there was a compactification scale, and we were writing the Lagrangian down there. So that was the thing that was all perturbative in powers of 1 over S. But then as you come down, one of the things that was there was this gauge coupling, T0, which was small. But as we come down, it's asymptotically free, and so it condenses. And what happens is that the gauginos get an expectation value. And that's the thing, the superpotential is essentially that. And that depends on the coupling constant, because it's essentially the confinement scale cubed on dimensional grounds. And so that's the cutoff, which is in this case the compactification scale times e to the minus some number divided by g squared. But g squared is t, so that's where this exponential is coming from. So it's the potential is getting generated because there's a non-perturbative thing happening when the confinement scale is reached, and that's what generates the potential.
And there's no freedom.
That part, there's no freedom. Now, that's what's nice about the supergravity theories, what the supersymmetric theories is that, because it's all holomorphic, you can really nail down exactly what that thing is.
That may be part of the same question. So at the minimum, R, S, and T, and therefore R and phi, as well as V effective, are all fixed.
Yeah.
In terms of some parameters.
Yeah.
The gauge quantization is presumably one parameter. The amount of gauge.
Well, the only parameter is really G, the six-dimensional gauge coupling in units of the Planck scale. And all these things are calculable in terms of it, because this is determined by T, which you then minimize to find its value, and that was 1 over G squared.
But you have to know how to calculate strong interactions in order to calculate that. Right?
To calculate this functional form, you have to, but in supersymmetric theories, we do know how to calculate those things. So that's not actually, this isn't a guess, this really is the answer. And it's because symmetry has completely determined the answer, that if there's an R symmetry in the problem which pins down.
So what exactly is R and phi and so forth in terms of that parameter then?
Oh, it turns out that, so you remember that T was R squared e to the phi, and S was R squared e to the minus phi. So R squared is like the square root of ST, and e to the phi is square root of T over S.
Yeah.
So you should be thinking that T is of the order of 1 over G squared, and S is of the order of e to the 1 over G squared. So you can see that what's happening is that e to the phi is exponentially small, because it's essentially e to the minus 1 over 2g squared,
yeah.
And the radius is exponentially large because the S is winning.
And V effective is what?
V effective is how big you would have thought it was. If you, in terms of the supersymmetry breaking scale, if you call the expectation value of F, the biggest one, if you call that mu squared, then the cosmological...
The new parameter?
Cube. No, this is calculable again. It's something which is related to lambda. I think it's something like... Here, I might be lying to you, but it's just from memory, I think it's lambda cubed over M Planck.
In calculus, in terms of perturbation theory or in terms of non-perturbation theory?
Both.
So you have to know how to calculate strong interaction theory.
You need to have a superpotential, so you need to know how to get the superpotential. So there's two issues. So the question you're really asking is, are you mixing orders of things, right? So the thing is that the superpotential, you know what it is, and there's no correction. So it's W naught e to the minus lambda t, let's say, and that's the answer, and that's exact. But then the Kähler function I told you was a series thing. It was like minus, 1 plus a over t plus stuff log s. And so you could say, well, maybe there's, e to the minus t stuff here, and there probably is e to the minus t stuff here. So after all the series stuff, there's going to be non-perturbative things that are systematically small, but there. But the point is that for this potential... The reason the superpotential is so important is that if it's zero, the potential is zero for the F terms. But once this is non-zero, the details of the shape of the potential could depend in principle on all these things. But it's subdominant stuff. The potential I gave you will be what it was, and this will be 1 plus order e to the minus t. So it'll be exponentially small again compared to what I told you, because it's a correction to something which is already contributing. Unless it was true that these terms are zero, and the first time you see a log s go with a t is coming from one of these terms, which I'm assuming is not true.
So are you telling me that for the dominant part, if I know the six-dimensional coupling constant g, then I should know everything? I should calculate everything?
Yes.
Calculate?
Yes.
And what are they, the result? Or you have not calculated them?
I've calculated them, and I'm just not remembering.
I'm sorry.
It's basically, I was about to finish it. It's the usual formula. It's if you have, you know, there's no new suppression of the cosmological constant here that wasn't there already. So typically what happens when you break supersymmetry is, you know, once you get an expectation value, then the cosmological constant likes to be F squared. And that's still true.
What's F squared?
F is this. It's basically the condensation scale with Planck masses in for dimensions.
So the condensation scale is calculable?
Yes. It's exponentially small compared to the compactification scale.
So it means that's exponentially small.
Yeah.
All of that.
Yeah. You tell me what G is and I can tell you what it is, though.
Three.
That's e to the one third. 1/9.
If F is the largest supersymmetric vector of the problem, then you know, we want to test this. F should be even at about 10 to 11 G.
Well, yeah. Now, if you're going to make models, then if there's no brains breaking supersymmetry too, then you design this to be the weak scale, say.
Okay.
But then the cosmological constant is not going to be particularly small, because it'll be the same as if you'd done some other. If you'd made up some stupid model which broke supersymmetry.
Okay.
So there's as far as I understand, there's no new suppression of the cosmological constant here.
Oh, okay. Is there any dynamical origin that you can imagine in the fixed supergravity which would generate this higher from the kind of...
Well, that's a great question. And so there's the short answer is no, and the long answer is yes. So I think the kind of thing that you would need... So I'm going to make a case that it's going to look like it's plausibly there, or what you would need to have it be there. But then I don't know how to get that, the thing you're going to need. So the kind of thing that you would need to get this kind of a term would be if you had in six dimensions, a curvature squared term at tree level, string tree level. So it would be like a sigma model correction to the defective theory. So if you had a term like root g in the string frame, e to the minus 2 phi, four-dimensional curvature times, say, two-dimensional curvature, that's the kind of thing that does it for you. If you kind of go to the Einstein frame and ask where do the r's and the phi's go, this is like a 1 over t correction. Oh, sorry, this times log of r. And that's the thing that's going to be hard to get. So this log r is what's going to be log of s in the end of the day. And this stuff is all going to be the 1 over t up front.
You know that at this constant in string theory, you know, you can try to calculate the time regression in general.
Right.
And basically just 1 over t or some powers of 1 over t without any log s.
That's often true, but that part actually I got a good answer to, because you can often get log of coupling constants, and the lamb shift is an example. And the way you get them typically is you get log of a mass, and the mass is proportional to a coupling constant.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly the situation here, because there was a gauge multiplet whose mass was going to go to zero when the dilaton got turned off. So the fact that you're getting corrections to the log terms isn't so surprising in this case, but the bad news is that what you normally expect to get is things like 1 over s log s. And I wanted 1 over t log s, and I was dropping all the 1 over s's, and so I don't know, I think I can actually calculate this, and this is there. Because these logs, because they're coming from logs of masses that are getting small, you can get them with a normalization group normally. But the 1 over t log s would come from a term like this, which would be a sigma model correction at string tree level. But I don't know how to get a log r. So if you're looking for a beta function, I don't know how to get a logarithm of the... Typically, those are polynomials in the field. So that's the thing I don't know how to do. I'm not optimistic you can actually get this in a sigma model calculation, but I think that the right calculation to do is a sigma model, one-loop sigma model correction to the six-dimensional compactation at string tree level. But first, you'd actually have to know how to get this from a string. And so I haven't told you how to get from 10 dimensions to 6 dimensions because I don't know how to do it. But that's what I think about.
Yeah, if the potential is almost flat like that, then if it starts from very energetic universe like ours,
yeah,
then it will not stay at local minimum and you will be always overshooting if it starts.
Ah, yeah. You might have thought that, but that's what these people did when they did this cosmology is that it's actually overdamped, so that the issue becomes if you plot the logarithm of the energy against the logarithm of the scale factor. So then, you know, the radiation is doing that, and matter is doing that. And so the scalar field, the question is, what does the scalar field do? And the statement is that if the scalar field energy starts off less than, you know, whatever's dominating at the time, which it has to be at nucleosynthesis, otherwise you're going to have, inconsistency with nucleosynthesis, from then on it becomes overdamped, and so it actually doesn't go very far. So that you'd think that you're going to just slide right through the potential, but it's an overdamped system, and so it just basically trickles along. And in the whole history of the universe, it might, log s might not go very far. Typically doesn't go very far, because it's depends on how much below the dominant energy you are here, but that's counterintuitive but true. Another way of saying it is that another class of models people often look at are these axion models, where you've got a potential energy which is kind of a fixed size, which is taking over now. You could ask, in those, the same intuition that you had would say that if I start off with a lot of kinetic energy for this thing, so say the kinetic energy is close to the typical energy densities in the very early universe, which is much bigger than, this is the size of the present-day cosmological constant, so it's zero. Then you might have thought that the kinetic energy you'd actually travel a lot in angle space in the history of the universe, but if you actually work it out, you go at most pi by 2, because it's so overdamped, it basically goes down once, and then it stops and turns around again. In the whole history, since Big Bang, new distances to now. So it's because it's overdamped, it's counterintuitive.
And this 6-dimensional gauge coupling is another moduli
string theory. Well, that's it. Yeah, I haven't talked about how to get it from 10 dimensions, and it would be a modulus. And then, so you'd have to, whatever it took you from 10 to 6, you'd want to fix every modulus you could. And I don't know how to do that. But that would be part of the problem, yeah.
Any more questions? Okay, thanks.